In my world, we're still not there. The labor delivery is far from over because she's going, came in with one body, three body organs, the bladder, the vagina, and the anus, and she has to leave with that body, and she has to leave with that, she has to live with that body for many, many years.
Welcome back to the Midwifery Wisdom Podcast. This week, I'm excited to share a conversation between Augustine and Malene Hegenberger. Malene is a Scandinavian CNM and the creator and inventor of the Hegenberger retractor, a tool used for suturing. In this conversation, Malene shares what brought her to midwifery and what prompted the invention of this novel tool. She shares about how vital and important the skill and procedure of suturing is and how this tool helps to make that more successful, her process in the invention, and the future of her tool. Together, Augustine and Malene also dive a little bit into balance and well-being for a busy life, and of course, a bit more into the specifics of suturing and why repairing and correct examination is true empowerment. You're not going to want to miss this conversation and opportunity to integrate a, quote, third hand into your suturing procedures. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the Midwifery Wisdom Podcast. We've been trying to make this conversation happen for so long. I'm so glad it's happening.
We have.
Well, Malene, thank you so much for being here. And let's start with an introduction because we have so much to talk about today.
We do.
So, will you say who you are, where you are, and what you do?
I am Malene Hegenberger, and I am a Danish nurse midwife. I was trained a nurse in Denmark, and I'm trained as a midwife in Norway. And I am a perineal expert here in Denmark. I work part-time clinical hours in a hospital where I teach suturing. I do labor deliveries, and then I run the postpartum tear clinic where I look at all the complex secondary tears and the episiotomies on day 3 to 5, and I do re-suturing of them if needed, and I do photo documentary of that. That's one side of my life. The other side is I'm the inventor behind the Hegenberger retractor. This device here, I can tell you a lot more about that. I had the idea back in 2016. I had the idea in my head for 10 years. I started the development in 2016. And then I went to market in 19, went into six market. I sold the company in 2021. We're now in 23 countries. So that's the other side of me, is that I'm a director of global training of distributors and clinicians in how to suture and use the Hegenberger retractor. I am the second midwife in the world to actually develop an obstetric tool. The last one was a French midwife in 1842. She invented the amnioscope, which she never got any credit for. So that's my life. Privately, I have a very nice boyfriend, and I have three sons with another man. I delivered the first one at home. The second was a cesarean section after a failed home delivery. And then the last one was a normal hospital delivery. So on the obstetric side, I've tried that too. So that's
You have all the experience now.
Yes.
Well, so Malene, I'm so excited that you're here. There's so many paths that we could go down because you have had such broad experience and now being a fairly well-known global inventor. It's very exciting. And so I definitely want to talk about entrepreneurialism and bringing a product to market. But first, I'd like to just kind of focus really closely on midwifery, because I think most of our audience are midwives, and I think they want to know some more specifics. So my first question is, why did you become a midwife? What was the draw? How did you get in this profession?
I was during my high school, I was a cleaning assistant in labor delivery. That means I was cleaning the labor wards, the labor suites, like you call it housekeeping in the US, in the US hospitals. And when on my coffee breaks, I was actually sitting in the staff room listening to the midwives, and I thought, those women are like the coolest people on this planet. And so I think that planted a seed. And then during high school, I was not really, I've never been a very good student. I was not a very good student back then. I was in very much of protest of what was expected. And I was like wearing military boots and was against the main flow, the mainstream, and et cetera, et cetera. And then at the same time, midwifery is one of the most difficult educations here in Denmark. It has a very high prestige. It's very difficult. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to get into the most difficult education in my own way. So that was my goal. And it took me 7 years through nursing first. And then I worked and I got accepted into midwifery in Norway. And so it's actually, it ended up being a very deep passion. I love taking care of patients. I really love studying nursing as well. There's something about the midwifery and the autonomy that we have as midwives here in Denmark, and you can say the feminism.
Can
you
feel
can
it.
incorporate. You can incorporate that in your care for these women, because if they get strong through labor and they get strong on the other side, you have definitely carried something forward, something within the feminine body. You have not deprived them anything. You have actually planted some very strong seeds in them to continue as mothers and women and or whoever you are. So I think I was raised by a strong mother. My mother was also a feminist, and so it came some part of her voice continued. She passed away last summer, but all through my life, she has been a very strong voice. And so I think she used her voice in other areas of women's rights, and I used my voice through midwifery. So.
It's so beautiful. Just as an aside, is there direct entry midwifery in Sweden or Norway or Denmark? It's only nurse
Yes, there
midwifery,
is, but
correct?
the only
Or
the I didn't have I have I'm very far from having the grades to get in, because you have to be a top student, and that's not necessarily the best midwives. And I always wanted to do both. I always wanted to do the nursing as well, because it broadens your
Scope.
opportunities later on in life. And that having said that, they only take like one or two nurses a year, so it would take you forever. So I was very determined to get into midwifery. So I did the nursing here, and then I went to London and worked there 2 years. And while I was studying psychology, they need you to have some kind of a year A-level psychology to get in. So I did that while I was working as a nurse, and then I got into Norway midwifery program. So I was very determined all through my nursing. I was very focused on the midwifery. And it took me like 6 years, 6 months still, you know, while I was studying in Norway, it took me like six months to start relaxing, because I thought whenever there was a knock on the door, somebody would come in and say, there's been a mistake. You're not really supposed to be here.
Oh, imposter syndrome is a hard one to outlive, right?
It is. So, but here I am, 20,
Here
22
you
years
are.
later.
Yeah,
Yes.
exactly. And going strong. Well, some people might wonder, but a lot of Scandinavian languages, you can kind of pick up the basics. Was it hard to go to school in Norwegian, or did you pick it up
No,
very quickly?
absolutely not. It's very similar to the Danish language. It's very close. Of course, they have very strong dialects, and you need to have a good ear for a language. But it's very, very Swedish and Danish is very different. Norwegian and Danish is very similar. So, yep. Of course, it takes time. It also takes time to pick up the phone and speak to a woman labor in Norwegian. But, yep. I mean, you learn right. as you grow. And so it was an absolutely honor and a big pleasure for me to study there for 2 years.
I had awesome.
The best years of my life. Yeah.
I love that. Well, how far into your career before you realize there's kind of a disconnect here? There's a problem. Like, I can see this challenge starting to emerge in my mind because you became this inventor who went through, I think, 88 prototypes before you launched it. And you spent years in development, obviously years before you were even in manufacturing, in your mind, refining this idea. How long into practice before you had this concept?
Well, the whole, you know, you have during your shift or during your career or during your years, you will always always have some different tasks. You know, some people find it difficult to maybe hear a blood pressure in their ears. You know, maybe that can be where they struggle. Just simple things, but you're always going to have little procedures, a little practices, a little practical moments that you always find cumbersome or difficult. And I had that with suturing, and it was a multi-spectral view on it because I also looked at it from the women's perspective or the patient's perspective. You know, I was causing pain because I had difficulty in finding the apex of the tear. I was maybe causing pain because I was inexperienced and maybe there was a little more trickle of blood than usual. Maybe it was an unusual tear and maybe it was a bad bed, you know, bad way of positioning her legs. Maybe the light was, you know, there were so many specters of this little procedure. And at the same time, this little procedure has a very big impact on that woman's life. And that was from the perspective of her. But for me, I was sitting badly. There was always something. I was physically tired because usually you do it after delivery. I always get that little kick of adrenaline when the baby's out, the APGAR score is great, the bleeding is under control. Then it's kind of your adrenaline kind of, you know, lowers a little bit and you kind of get that lovely tiredness that you get. And at the same time, you have a very important procedure in front of you that you have to do with the same elegance, with the same precision, with the same focus as you do everything else. But it is a very difficult procedure because of the positioning of it. You don't want to burden her with changing her position. You actually, what you would like to do is just leave her alone with the baby and just go out and do your papers or, you know, just cover her up and say that was it. And that is not in her favor if you do that. So there's a lot of factors that make that procedure a little bit difficult. And I was also thinking, well, it's a women practice taking care of women. So that's where there's the least focus, there's the least prestige, there's the least investment, there's the least innovation. There's this little procedure lacks so much attention. The father's happy because the baby's out. The hospital's happy because the baby's out and healthy. The mother's not bleeding. But in my world, we're still not there. The labor delivery is far from over because came in with one body, three body organs, the bladder, the vagina, and the anus. And she has to leave with that body. And she has to leave with that. She has to live with that body for many, many years.
Yeah, so yeah, I talk a lot about lifetime function, you know?
It is
necessary, yeah.
It is, mm-hmm. And it's not just an armpit where you can just show it whenever you want to, you know?
It's functional,
It is very functional. It's mm-hmm. your self-esteem, it's your sexuality, it's very key body functions, plain body functions. Anyway, so after having sat there for some time, I was just thinking I think either you have that innovative mindset or you don't. But I always come up with, you know, thinking this could be done better, this could be done better. But the fact of the matter is I do sit in that situation a lot. When you are a midwife, it's a situation I sit in a lot due to my work. And that means I was reflected in those problems all the time. They kept being come back to my mind. And at the end, I was like, if only I could play something that would hold this open so I can actually get in there and do my job. Compared to all the surgical procedures where you see all the innovations go into robotics, lights, non-invasive surgeries, you name it, knee surgeries, yeah. You're up and walking after 3 hours, and
yeah,
physiotherapy, all of that. The other day I was down in the OR last week, and I was moving my head to look at the tear in a different way, and this huge robotic light behind me moved with me. And I was like, oh my God, this is not happening. And I was like, can you imagine the millions of crowns that's been invested into that light source? And then I go back to my labor delivery and we can hardly afford leg rest, you know? So that is, that also
is that a, isn't a window into the patriarchy. I don't know what is. Wow.
That is just, you know, you go down to the surgery and there is so much innovation, so much prestige, and you go back up to labor delivery and we place the legs in leg rest and we sit there, we're using our fingers as retractors like we've done for so many years and
centuries, really. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So that's how that whole...
And how far into your career? Was this like year one or were you 10 years in before you were like, I can make this better?
I'd been a midwife for 6 years.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. That's just a good frame of reference because I've noticed a trend in midwifery, and it's like the first 3 or 5 years is just like enthusiastic and exciting and innovative and just like, woo, 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 there's things coming all the time and you're finally putting all those practice skills to work and you're wondering what's next. But around the 5-year mark, there becomes, people either go one of two ways. They either continue to look for new and different and exciting, or they kind of veer towards burnout and being like, actually, I don't really want to do this anymore. And so I love that we could actively encourage ourselves to, when we hit that, like, okay, this is repetitive and kind of boring, what do I do next? Continue to imagine that we could follow your path and be innovative and really try to create something new. So let's shift into this incredible journey that you've been on, where you invented, developed, brought to market, and then sold a company based on an invention. This is massive. This is really incredible. I mean, it's like, if we're really talking about the patriarchy, like, what better way to smash the patriarchy than to do what you've done, which is play on a level playing field and actually make money and change the world at the same time. It's very exciting. I'm really, really excited to talk to you.
So, but the whole reasoning why I think it became something or it became its success is that in the beginning I worked with it at home. You know, I looked at it like some people they're sitting and knitting in the sofas while they are, you know, they're relaxing after a day. They look at TV. They do something with their hands, or maybe they read books. And in my case, I was making retractors on the kitchen table. But the whole thing that kept fueling it with energy is that I could actually control the process myself. And I think that's very applies to a lot of midwives or women in all, because I still had 3 quite young children. And if I had signed up to a master program, or if I'd signed up to an innovative master school scholarship or something, I would have been put in a box. They would have told me to be innovative and to be, you have to put 17 hours a week into this, and you have to deliver a project in 6 months, and you have to pitch it, and you have to. And just by thinking of that, all the innovation goes out. No, yeah. So here I could actually take it in and out of my closet whenever I had an hour, whenever I had the energy. I was not forced to be innovative. I was not forced to pass a deadline or to reach the deadline and come up with this magic solution. So that's how it actually became something. You know, it was a slow process. It was a slow snowball. And I think that speaks into a lot of women at that place of time, because some nights you will have one tight kid that won't go to sleep, so you will spend the evening taking care of that kid, and you can't go down and spend 3 hours in front of the computer without burning out. So that was the key for me, is that I could actually control that. But once I had the prototype and once I had the investors on board, then and you formed it, you found the company, of course, that's where you put a line in the sand, and that's then it becomes serious. But then I had matured in my mind so much. I had matured as a person, and I had matured with the project. So I was actually ready for that snowball, for that more serious chapter of the whole journey. And I think
tell us the time frame between that 6-year mark, like, okay, I'm going to actually put some energy into this. Then you did a kitchen table project for a year and a half.
Yes. And then we did about, I think I did about 40 prototypes at home with paper, with different materials. And I found a woman who actually donated her body, her vagina, to my project, because I needed the same body. Because if I placed the prototypes in 10 different women, I would keep having to, I would never have the same changes. So So that's how I actually got the prototype to a very finished stadium. And then I got accepted into Innovation Hub. That's the first place where I could actually speak in confidentiality, which is something that women should know as well. Don't discuss your ideas without any without being within a confident room. But again, there you had to follow they had a 12-step process. But because I came with my finished prototypes, I was actually almost at the end of their journey. So I only you could say use their 3D printer. So that's suddenly from the kitchen table being a little odd prototype, I actually got it out through a 3D printer, and it became a really nice clinical product all of a sudden. And then it all started to shape. And around the investors came at the same time. We founded the company. We got the prototypes. We kept developing them and adjusting them. And the final 6 months before we went to market, I had a design team come on to look at the retractor from a different perspective, because I had only the clinical, and I wanted to refine the whole design so that it looks elegant, it looks feminine, and at the same time, it's a clinical tool. I wanted the retractor to give those kinds of symbols, but I also wanted to be intuitive. And you have to remember, you're using gloves and you have blood on your hands, so it has to be something tactile. So so there was all these little things. Those guys helped us with that in the end. And then
they were industrial designers, or where did you find them?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're called Made by Makers. They're here in Denmark. And they're very good. And it took a lot of discussions, because they had to understand where I was coming from. And of course, they look at it from a more interior industrial design. I said, it has to be for women. It has to be for clinicians. So we can't.
Yeah.
I didn't want to argue with that.
Yeah.
So, but you learn as you grow. I found 6 countries. I got it into 6 territories, and then it was time for the company to. And then COVID hit, so it came kind of right under the radar to save the money and only spend money on the IP rights. And then we went. We found a company that was willing to buy it during the COVID, actually. But in the meantime, I got it into 6 countries, and I started to sell. But that's also something I just did. You just have to jump. And of course, looking back, I've made some mistakes. I was ready to sell it to the right buyer, and the right buyer came along. And because I'm a clinician, I don't have that business mindset. That whole QR code on how to get it out there, and how to push the price, and how to get the most out of the price, and all that. I'm not that kind of person. I have to lean back into my clinical skills. That's where I shine. That's where I bring value. And then I knew that to lift it to different countries, we had to place it in the hands of the right people with that kind of knowledge. And together we are a strong team. I can't pretend I'm a business person. I'm not. I'm a clinician, and that's where my force is.
And an inventor. Clinician and inventor.
The motivator.
Yeah. And so you're still involved with the company, though.
I am. I'm director of global training. So I do a lot of traveling to different countries. We just entered the US, so I do a lot of traveling to the East Coast. Yeah. And then I meet with doctors or clinicians, midwives. I teach them how to use the Hagenburger, but I also teach the distributors, the ones that are going to actually visit the clinicians in the different countries. They need to have a clear concept of how to use the Hagenburger, because I can't be in at every conference, at every hospital. So I've just been to Norway for 2 days. I've just been to England for 1 day. And so that's my other side, my part-time job next to the hospital.
Awesome. Well, let's get a little clarity, because there are two words associated with your invention, both speculum and retractor. So people who are not familiar, can you walk them through the names and what means what?
Yes, the first couple of years we called it Hagenburger speculum. And that was because a speculum is a medical device or an instrument that you place in a cavity that's already there. That means an opening, a physiological opening in the body. That means you have speculums for the nose, you have speculums for the ears and the eyes, anus. That's called a proctoscope, but that is a general name for looking in the depth of an orifice that's already there, an existing opening. A retractor is, which you could say you do with a Hagenburger, you don't look at the cervix, but you look quite high up in the vagina. But with a retractor, that is what you place in a surgical incision or in an opening where you need to look at a surgical wound or trauma in the depth. That means you have retractors for skin. You could open the skin. You have retractors for the vagina, or you can also have for the thoracic or abdominal surgery or back surgery. So anything that holds aside so you can look further down, that's a retractor. So it took us a long time to discuss this. And we actually decided with the new company to change the name, because it actually, the vagina is an opening that's already there, but the trauma is there. And we want to open the trauma so you can actually, or the tear, so you can actually see the depths of the tear and the different layers of the anatomy. So that's why we wanted to change it.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. So it is now called the Hagenburger Retractor.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's a funny thing, because I thought that was not going to be a big thing. I thought, well, people are just going to adapt it, but it's amazing that people still remember it as Hagenburger Speculum. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So that has taught me a lot about your name picking, you know, what you start out with, because it's good
very
to
important.
Think that. Yeah.
Yeah. Very important. Well, it is, I mean, it really is remarkable to be a practicing midwife who had an idea at your kitchen table that went through basically an innovation incubator, found investors, started a business, and launched a medical device, mostly single-handedly. I know you had some design influence and, you know, some counseling from the business end, but really, this is truly your creation. And like you said, there are very few of you. Now, certainly, there are other midwives that are involved in creating, in inventing, but they do not replace medical devices. They are a new kind of a concept, like, you know, the Dubai birth stool or the recessive cradle or things that didn't really work really a thing before and aren't used in the mainstream. What I love about what you've been able to do is really replace some antiquated equipment and move it into the mainstream. And it's really exciting. It's really worth celebrating. What do you think is next for you? What are you going to do next? Do you have other devices swirling around in your head?
Oh, I have a lot of devices.
I bet you do.
Well, we are looking at what we can do next with the Hagenburger. I have different options with it. We're looking at a light source for it at the moment. That's in the pipe drive. And then I have other inventions that are not medical that I would certainly look into when that doesn't need to be FDA approved or CE certificated, because that is a nightmare.
That is a nightmare.
I'm also looking at, I'm hoping, I'm looking for different materials. So it doesn't have to be single use plastic. That is a very high on my list, because if there's one thing I don't like about the Hegberger is that it's single use, and I don't mind single use items, but I do not like that it's plastic material. So, but it's a very long journey, because it has to be EU approved, and it has to be EU approved for medical devices. So as it is now, it's going to be a while. But that is certainly something that has my priority. What kind of new, can we make it out of corn? Can we make it out of sugar? Can we mix it into the plastic? But it needs the flexibility. It has to be very, very flexible. So, and back in the days, I thought of making it into aluminum, but that would simply be so sharp here that it would cut up the vagina when you removed it. So that would be it would simply not be approved. And it took about a year to decide on the material. So it's not something that you just sleep over. It's a lot of testing. It's a lot of discussions back and forth. I did have a board when I did it. So I had some really good people around me I could discuss all these things with. But that is one of the things that I would like to look into, and how we can actually change that. It's the same with, you know, when you look at, you know, a bottle of shampoo is about 50 grams of plastic. And I keep saying to myself, well, Malene, how many bottles of shampoo is a woman using per year with conditioning? That's probably about 6 or 8 bottles of shampoo every year, where a woman would use one of these per lifetime. So if you look at the plastic industry, you have to look at where it's the mainstream use, like plastic bottles and lunch boxes and all these things. If you go into CVS, how much of that plastic is could actually be, you know, how much of that is life-saving or life-changing? So, but still, we all the hospitals here in Scandinavia are looking very much into how we can reduce the single-use market. Yeah. So that is one of the things on my list. But at the same time, you also have to make a product that's safe. You cannot place bamboo in a woman that's been sutured in the OR. You cannot place sugar because it will simply break and degrade. Whenever you're dealing with a surgical instrument or whenever you're dealing with medical devices, you have to be absolutely sure that it's clean, that it can be sterilized, and that it's safe to place in contact with that many kinds of human beings under open surgery. So these are all things that are important to me, but it also has to be put into a perspective, you know, time-wise. Yeah. You will never get it approved by the EU or the FDA if it's not a medical product, a material, you could say. Yeah. That's what's on my
Yeah, if we're stopping single use, maybe stop the plastic shampoo bottles before the medical devices. That's not the order of things. Yes.
Exactly. That's the mindset I would like, because I have a lot of critique for it being single use. But look, go home and look at your bathroom, you know, look at your cupboard when you have a shower, and look what kind of plastic do you have there that is actually raw oil plastic. Like the big containers we have at my hospital that we use for sharps, they are starting to use those or make those in bamboo now. And that is, you know, why not? That is solid plastic. And you can make all these things. If you look at the plastic industry, there's so many of the things that are non-essential that we can actually start looking at. So that is, you know, one of the things that are high on my list to look at.
Yeah, that's exciting. That's really exciting. Well, so you're very busy. You doing basically 2 or 3 jobs. How do you get balance in your life? Because as you start to expand and you add more and more of your passion projects, and you have a regular job, and you have a research study, and you know, like, how do you find balance? I think that's probably a struggle a lot of midwives face. But what's your secrets for what's your trick?
I don't look for balance, but when I'm tired, I'm tired. So that's where I make a hole in my calendar. And luckily, I'm that kind of person that doesn't need 2 weeks to rebound. And plus, I get a lot of energy from my work. I relax, not to degrade my work at my hospital, but there I'm very relaxed. I'm one of the old birds in the department. I love what I do. I simply love going to a hospital. I love putting on my uniform. I love having coffee with my colleagues, we are having so much fun. It's a really nice mm-hmm. place to be. I love meeting the patients. I love seeing their faces when they leave. And if you put that into your batteries, you have a little more for the days where you have less energy. I have tired days. When I go in my car, I'm really tired, but it's good tired. It's not that I can't breathe, or it's not like I feel like I'm having an anxiety attack. I don't feel, if I have any signs of that, trust me, I will pull the handbrake. I have a brother who suffered tremendously from stress. I've seen it very close-handed, how he lost a very beautiful career. And so that's very close to my heart, very close to my brain. I think if I don't look at balance, I look at well-being. Mm. If I feel well, if I have time to speak to my children, if I sleep well, if I have time to do my fitness and do my journeys or travel, I'm actually a very lucky person.
Yeah, so maybe that's the balance, is that well-being is the metric. Mm. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because balance, awesome. I don't think I will ever find a balance, because if I sit too much in the sofa, I'll be eager to do something.
That's not balance.
it's about, you know, waking up, being happy with what you're doing. As long as there's, and the majority of your days are good, I think you should be very happy. And whenever you look in the mirror in the morning and you are looking forward to a new day, you're very happy. And if you start counting the days where you or feel that majority of your days are not very positive or negative, or you don't sleep well, all those great signs, so then it's time to evaluate your. And I have a lot of honey jars, I call it. I have a lot of that I can always look at and say, well, if this is not working, I have something else that I want to do. So there's always something hope. So there's also hope and energy in the next honey jar, because if I burn out this, it doesn't mean I burn out forever. You can look out and find your next perspective. That will give you a way of breathing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
That makes sense at all.
It does, actually. It makes a lot of sense. You are a multi-passionista as well, I believe. That's how I describe myself, because I've got lots of spinning plates. Yeah, I love that.
Augustine and Malene are about to dive a bit more into the benefits of this incredible tool. But before we got into that, I wanted to share with you an offering that you should definitely keep your eye out for. Coming in the next month, Midwifery Wisdom will be launching our newest course, Suturing After Birth. As a midwife, you know that proper suturing is more than just a skill. It's a cornerstone of quality care for birthing individuals. With 30% of birthers experiencing tears during childbirth, the ability to perform a precise and effective repair is absolutely crucial. So consider this. The quality of suturing directly impacts birthing individuals' lifetime bowel, bladder, and sexual function. A poorly identified injury or a subpar repair can lead to years of discomfort, dysfunction, and even repeat surgeries. That's why mastering the art of suturing isn't just important, it is absolutely essential. In this course, Augustine takes a deep dive into going over equipment essential for suturing, knot tying, types of stitches, suturing methods, grading perineal injury, suturing in real life with actual real life videos. So keep your eye out. You are definitely not going to want to miss this course.
Well, so let's go into the product itself. We have a lot of practicing midwives who are in our audience, and I would love for you to describe what the device helps you with, why it would be beneficial to add this to your practice.
Well, if you have like a high vaginal tear, let me show you this little girl.
Perfect. Yes.
Yeah, we have a vulva with a tear, 6 o'clock. So you can use the Hengberger is like your third hand. So you can place it where this one has a tear down, it's straight down. So you can see straight in. If you have a high lateral tear, you simply put it in sideways. So it's where you would have placed your fingers. As long as you don't turn it around like this, that's not what it meant for. These circles here on the side are if you have a complex tear and you need to place some sutures without tying the knot. So if you're training as students, you can hang them there. If you're doing a sphincter injury in the OR or some, or if you have a home birth delivery or clinical birth, if you have a high vaginal tear and an artery, you can simply place it quite higher up and then you can reach the apex quite easily. It is just your third hand. That means that you don't have to go in and get the needle with your hand. We always learn to, at school, we learn to suture with a needle holder and a forceps, and then we go out in the real world and there's no way you could go in there and get it with your fingers without letting go of. So this is actually what I needed myself. I need an extension of my two fingers. And also, it gives some kind of control for the women, because our fingers are moving around, especially women with sexual assault history or any kind of, it sounds really odd, but they love this one because they trust it. It sits still. It's not moving around. It's not touching you unpredictably. Even though we speak to the women, our fingers are a little bit unpredictable. And also if you have, like, my worst tear is intact perineum and then a deep tear down behind, you can place the Hagenberger and then you can actually stand up and then you can actually look down and get the muscles behind the perineum. And in Scandinavia, here in Denmark and in Norway, we use Alice Forceps to kind of identify the muscles, even though it's a second degree tear or an episiotomy, and they're hanging down, and then we grab them. And I know this is not a suturing course, but just a background. In Denmark and Norway, we suture the vagina in one or two layers, but we suture it continuously, and then we tie a knot at the hymen ring, and then we close the musculus transverse and the bulbo in two different segments. And then we close the subcutaneous tissue and the skin with continuous sutures. So that's just the approach that we have here. I know there's different ways of suturing.
Yeah, I teach a very similar. So yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so and here you can certainly you can hang your sutures. For instance, if you're closing
the vaginal floor.
Or whatever you want, you can hang it there. Or if you have an Alice forceps, you can hang them here. It's just, I wanted to create a tool.
A visual
that,
field. Yeah.
Yeah. Where you could actually, you have a finger in the anus. Where's the anus here? You have a finger in the anus and you can lift it up and actually inspect the rectovaginal fascia. You can close that one before you close the mucosa or examine it. So especially in women with a high BMI, this is really, really useful as well. We use it for all our students instead of having one standard hold aside. Mm-hmm. But also for the women, there's a slight discomfort when you place it because you are touching the cervix, and there's also a little discomfort when you remove it. But during the whole procedure, the Hagenberger itself should not be uncomfortable at all. I've removed six in 3 years. Three of the women were sexual assault, and two of them were an overextended bladder. And then the last one was, we simply could not pain control her, so we had to take her to the OR. But if something is, you know, it has to be placed.
Oh, once it's placed, they don't complain.
Once it's placed correctly. And one thing that's important is that her legs has to be up in leg rest. And that can be an issue in home birthing or in some clinical
settings.
Well, I'm
happy to report that we have a new product at Midwifery Wisdom. If you haven't seen yet, the Suture Assistant is a portable stirrup. So it's underneath the mattress for home and has footrests for them that can be swiveled out further if they need to be. And there's a space for the midwife. So that's on our website, midwifereewisdom.com/shop. And these are the things. We bring them together and then we have solutions, right?
Yeah. Yes. Oh, that sounds perfect. That's a perfect combination. Because it's my my motto is that, you know, it's not in the, one thing I do find interesting when we are taking care of women, I don't know about the US, but we discuss it a lot. Well, at least I discuss it a lot, is that when it comes to taking care of women after birth, we kind of mix in a lot of emotions. We kind of tend to mix in emotions in the care, and it's not always the right place to do that. I think I always used to drive the ambulance in the US as well. And there, when we went to a trauma and we brought them into hospitals, we would not degrade the level of care because they've been through something terrible, or we would not say, oh, this is not good, you know, this, I feel so sorry for you, so I'm not going to do an x-ray. We would never do that to other people. And I see that in women, you know, we say, no, I'm not really going to inspect you that much because this is the golden hour, this is the time for you to connect with your baby, let's just deliver the placenta. And, you know, and I love the connection between the mother, the newborn, all that. But I still think that she deserves a correct inspection and a diagnosis and a high level care.
And repair if needed. And a repair.
And a repair. And yeah. Correct repair.
I agree so much with this. And there there is this incredible toxic concept that we are injuring them when we interfere, when in fact, the longer you delay repair after birth, the more you actually hurt them.
Because there's no involvement in leaving the woman alone. You know, there's empowerment in suturing them correctly and leaving and repairing them and inspecting them and giving them a correct diagnosis. It's all about the way that you do it. I understand that they've just been through a labor. They just became mothers or whatever they identify as. But you can do all of that with a very high level of empathy for the situation. You can still be very professional with a high level of communication in a gentle way, in the pace that is not depriving her of that high sense of energy
or accomplishment, bonding with their baby.
If breastfeeding is high on her agenda, well, then let's take the legs down and focus on that for an hour. And then we do the repair later on. But whenever you do it well. That's my whole message. It's not empowerment to let them be mothers without a good repair.
I would just, high five for that one. It is not empowering to tuck someone in bed with a gaping wound. It is not empowering to say good job and leave them without full bowel, bladder, or sexual function. It is not empowering to go back and try to put needles in their bottom after a lot of their nerve function has come back 2 or 3 hours after the birth. That's not empowering, actually. That's traumatic. We have to
evaluate the repair in my own department. We never diagnose alone anymore in my department. We always have to be two midwives diagnosing them to suture. We have a very high level on training and focusing. And yet I think I re-suture one woman every Monday. And I take a lot of pictures, and I also refer women to other levels of care because they need a complete re-operation. But it's just, I'm not blaming anyone. I'm just saying that we have to acknowledge as midwives that we do our very best when we do the repair, but it's biology, it's different anatomy, it's different tissues, and sometimes we don't. It's complicated, and we need to acknowledge that sometimes we can be better. Like I spoke to a medical student in Norway last week, and he says, well, we get six, what did he say? He says, we get a 30-minute course in perineal repair. He says,
whoa.
And I was like, sorry? And we have to acknowledge that the modern women, the women that are coming today and the future, that is what they're going to be, you know, worried about. It's not about pain anymore, because if you deliver at home, you are okay with that kind of labor pain that you experience. If you're going to deliver in a clinic, you're also okay with that. If you're going to the hospital, you might want other kinds of pain levels, but you have choices in many parts of the world. So now the women are worried that something is going to happen to their baby, and they're worried that they're going to have an injury that will be misdiagnosed or misrepaired. I think that's top.
So the solution is to make it easier for the clinician to do their job well. And that includes your retractor, which I think is a brilliant invention. It includes a bright light. It includes having the client positioned in such a way that they can be comfortable throughout the process. And then what I harp on a lot when I teach suturing is that it involves the midwife getting themselves in such a position that they can comfortably maintain for the duration of the needed time, which might be 20 minutes, but it might be an hour, depending on how complex it is or how much they need you to break and take a break. And there's this whole body mechanic piece that is also a part of this. And I love what you were describing. Like, I need three hands. And oftentimes we would make our students be the retractors.
Exactly.
But that's intense for the student's body mechanics, and it's super intense for the client.
They don't learn anything
because they're not watching. They're busy trying to help their position. I love this. What a fantastic thing you've done. I just want to thank you for all of midwifery. Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen and to have all these good questions. I like to inspire other midwives, and you don't have to have a background in engineering or law to jump into this. But if you have a little bit of energy, you can also be one or two. You can go together as two midwives, find up. Like, I just like to say a little motivational history from one of my old colleagues. She's very, very tall, very tall midwife. And she said, Malene, I want to invent a new labor bed, a new labor bed for tall midwives, so I can actually get close to the woman. I don't have to bend that down that much, because all the delivery beds, they don't go that high. And she said, but I'm a welder. I can't just start working with metal at home and all these things. And she'd already packed away the whole project. And I said, well, you know what? You need to start pretending you are Barbie, and then you sit at home in your kitchen and you make a little labor bed for Barbie. Pretend that bear Barbie is 2 meters tall, and then you make a little labor bed for her with a little prototype, and you make a little adjustment, and then you can take it in and out of the closet, just like I did with the retractor. And she was like, it was like a light bulb, like, of course, she can make prototypes at home. And then when you have that tiny little labor bed prototype, then you go to the welder and say, do this for me. So it's all about setting up your own success. You don't have to be,
meeting yourself where you are.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's so inspiring, I think, for everyone listening. It's like, you can start right where you are, shrink or modify it in such a way that you physically can work on this idea until you're ready. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's really brilliant. Well, so where can people get their hands on this brilliant device?
Well, they can always contact me. I am on Instagram. I'm Malene Hagenberger. I'm LinkedIn. I'm not difficult to find. We also have the Hagenberger Medical website. They can always write to that. We have 5 distributors in the U.S., so we're in about 22 states. And if you are in one of the states where we are not actually, we certainly can ship to your state. We have a warehouse in Minnesota, I think it is. I will be in New York a lot on the East Coast, because that's where logistically I can start. And we have some very good contacts, but certainly we're going to move. We have some really good collaborative distributors that are very flexible, and also California. So I see a big potential in the U.S. I see the curiosity in the U.S. and also because you are very open to innovative things. Your country is just the Americans. I was married to an American. My ex-husband was from the U.S. So I've spent a lot of my time in the U.S. I also worked there for 4 years on the East Coast. So I feel at home on the East Coast. That's why I'll be focusing there. But certainly reach out if there's anything or any interest. And we are looking at midwives in New York area, actually, to support us. We're looking at the moment for 4 midwives with high-level clinical expertise within perineal a repair that can assist us with the Hengberger. So if anyone in your network is nurse midwives or midwives from New York, they can certainly reach out. We are going to post job description in the next couple of weeks online. So it is, but I want the Hengberger to be more than a product. Of course, I want it to be a business, but I want it simply to be a bridge to improving. I want it to be a symbol of taking the women's body seriously after the birth. Yeah. I want it to be a symbol of taking the training seriously. So if you're a hospital or somewhere and you take suturing or perineal repair or perineal diagnostic suturing seriously, you will have or look into the Hengberger. I want it to be because when you look at the pregnancy, how many hours of screening and ultrasound we spent, and also during active labor, how much we spend on fetal monitoring, and we do timeouts every 4 hours. Is it actually progressing, or are we happy, or should we do so, should we not? Diabetic, smoking.
There's so much.
And as soon as the baby's out, as soon as the bleeding's under control, there's zero investment in the women's body. And that's so provocative.
It really is.
Coming
it's
from
a concept.
It's not done.
Like, it's a concept of like woman as vessel, right? And so that's the concept that we have to shatter. And you're helping with that tremendously. I know there are others working in this space, but it sure is exciting to hear from you today.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.